So, titled Nightmare Ferret. Basically, I'll read out the story. A ferret escaped from its owners, climbed through an open window a few streets away, and bit a sleeping man on the nose. Stuart Arminger, 28, of Brighton, said it sunk its teeth right in. It was a massive shock. And it doesn't say anything else, but I picked this up in the Telegraph a few days later, and the ferret actually moved from Brighton to Stockport and joined a jazz band. And that's the last that we heard of him. That was on Wednesday, so...
Yeah. It's a continuing story that we'll keep our eyes open.
Joined a jazz band, as a cover, as a slight cover for kids.
Right. Oh, right, oh, I see. Yeah.
He's on the run, yeah.
He had to go on the run, yes.
Some people join the
he can't go around shocking sleeping men.
Exactly. Who knows where he is now?
Hello, and welcome to Saffron Planet once again. Do let us know if you've seen this ferret up north in this jazz band. It'd be really interesting to know how well he's doing. What are we looking at today, Steve?
We've got three talks. First one is, in fact, I've really dumped Simon on this because I give him a very provocative question. I won't say what it is until we start the thing. So that's the first one. Second one is we go over to Pakistan, our friends the Middletons, the missionaries who were there during and after 9/11.
Yeah, so we're literally in Pakistan. We're around our dining room table.
Well, yeah. And then we just do films. Our second part of our discussion, films from a Christian perspective. Right, so, on to the first one.
Mm-hmm.
The question.
God, what's all that about, son? God, is there a God?
Are you asking a
Yeah, get your immediate reaction, straight from the gut.
Scientifically, no.
Scientifically, no.
Because we can't perform a scientific test, and we, you know, with evidence.
And that's the only way to actually determine if something is real.
Not, but you're asking me a simple question, and I'm giving you a simple, basic answer.
So that's just using your reason, then. Your reason tells you.
Yeah.
So God is not reasonable.
No, I mean, from that particular angle, there's no sort of empirical evidence to suggest that.
Okay, so you say there's no evidence for God, so we're going to try to discover some evidence for God.
Okay.
So where should we start? The truth is out there.
Oh no,
my hypothesis is that the truth is out there, and God is truth, therefore God is out there. So. I suppose it's a case of exploring where we think God speaks to his people, or any people. Now, as Christians, we believe he speaks to us through the Bible, but, of course, God speaks to us through other ways, because the Bible hasn't always been around. And you know, there's nature, there's, you know, many other aspects of this world where God can find a way to speak to us. So, what can we speak about? Well, design.
Okay. Yeah,
that's a good argument.
Mm-hmm.
Easily defeated, I imagine, if you're Richard Dawkins, perhaps. But
what?
Human body design, DNA. DNA is designed. It has to be designed. So we have a DNA expert with us. Who's sitting there like a rabbit in the headlight. Trying to think. The whole point of this programme is not to sound too clever. So,
okay, yeah. Well, that's not difficult.
No. But, I mean, DNA, as far as I can tell, DNA is the mechanism by which, you know, we transfer from father to son, you know, like the genetic fingerprint.
Information, yes.
But it has to start somewhere, doesn't
exactly.
it? So, what's the argument against that? The first DNA was an accident. Is that what you were saying, Simon?
Not an accident, but it was a good bit of luck mixed in with with the laws of physics.
So DNA, which is a molecule, from remember, when you, if you unravel one DNA from your cell, it can come from here to the moon and back 30 times. One DNA in one cell in the human body.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
But there's like there's two strands of approach. There's the one where you'd say God is amazing and that he's so amazing, look what he's done. And then there's the other argument that it's only like this because it's taken billions of years to get like this. Yeah. And it's not something that's miraculous and of God, but it's something that is only like this because it's evolved through time, and that it's got this complex through billions of years of
evolving. Can I just
evolving?
Interrupt you?
Yeah, well, absolutely. Yeah.
About this question of evolving, if something has to evolve, it evolves in small steps, and each step has to show at some kind of advantage, some mechanism which has evolved, even if very simplistic, which means that this, it's not a creature, but this fragment is going to survive. Yeah. Why should it survive? What makes it survive out of all the other fragments?
Yeah. The whole point of evolve is that evolving implies getting better.
Getting better.
Otherwise it'd be devolve.
And there's some what's the word I'm looking for?
Advantageous.
Advantageous. Yeah. And if you use a Darwinian principle, it falls down completely.
Yeah.
Okay. The Darwinian theory has been, most scientists wouldn't, you know, align themselves with strict Darwinian theory anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Strict Darwinian. So, you know, it's that argument. I would say, if you're arguing that things don't seem to have progressed in a, a positive step, then you could turn around and say, well, where's intelligent design in that?
Yeah, intelligent design would say, on that, it's there. Mm. You know, you don't have to worry about steps. You don't have to worry about how it got there.
There were no steps.
It's got there, you know. And
so why would we need to have steps if
don't.
The initial design was so good? Or, you know...
You mean like, I suppose there are species that you could actually see that there is evolution, you know, sort of depending on a certain part of evolution, like environmental factors that is proven.
But that's not really evolution. Yeah. I mean, no. It's really showing how a particular range of the species survives.
Yeah.
It doesn't actually show a species changing to another species.
No. So it's micro, not macro.
That's right, micro.
Okay, so we're arguing that one of them is okay and we don't have any problem with.
So evolution does occur, but on a micro level that is acceptable to Christians and
so micro's okay, macro's bad? Yeah?
Yes. Right? Well, not bad, it just doesn't exist.
Doesn't exist. Okay. So we've disproved that, have we?
And I would also, so going back on Simon's original point where you said that scientifically you can't prove that God exists.
Okay.
Well, I would argue that because... scientifically, you can't prove that the wind exists. You can only prove the effect of the wind.
Mm.
And there are so many things in science where you don't have empirical evidence. You can't measure it.
The cause of that wind as well, but you can't. There's no proof. There's no creator of God, but there's a. You can create wind, but there's no proof. You know, you can't. If you're going to use an argument to use in one angle, you have to use that same argument with a second angle, but then that argument breaks down. So, yeah.
So what? So you've demolished his argument just like that?
No, I'm just saying. Some arguments are good, but...
Yeah, okay, well, say the original question was, you know, does God exist? And and you're talking it strictly from a scientific point of view. And,
well, that's just... Yeah,
okay, that's all right. I mean, that's...
Got to start somewhere, I suppose.
Of this age, when we look at all the books that have been written lately and all the people that are... The atheist's main argument is an argument from science, they would say, like Dawkins and Hitchens and all those people. They would look at science as a way of giving an alternative to God. But I'd say God, you know, appears in other...
Saffron. Well, I think that was quite a difficult subject to tackle. I think we struggled a little bit on that. I think we'll bring in an expert. Just to mention that we know or have heard of John Mackay and Ken Ham and another gentleman.
Yeah, Monty White. There's quite a few of them, and we promise in the near future to bring in one of these people and make the debate a bit more meaty.
That's great. And at this point, also, I want to mention that Steve's written a book. as well, called The Truth Is Out There. You might have heard that title within that conversation, I'm not quite sure. But,
a shameless plug.
That was a very good book to read, and gives the reasons for the existence of God and where we can actually recognise God. What's the second topic?
Okay, as I said earlier, on to Pakistan, though not literally. Friends of ours who we've known for many years came back from Pakistan a few years back, and they tell part of their story of what happened around the time of 9/11. So quite an illuminating
how it affected them and their family while they were in Pakistan and they heard the news.
Yep. Okay, off we go.
So were you there actually during 9/11?
Yes, we were. Yes, we saw it on the television. Yeah. But we were at home, and a friend of ours, I think, was that right, Mary? She rang us up and said, "You've got to look at this on the television."
Spoke to Margaret, actually. We'd both been out. You'd been out here in England. We'd been out in Pakistan. We came home, had a lovely conversation on the telephone. Mm-hmm. And then the next phone call was, "Have you seen what's on the television? Have you heard what's happened?" And after that, we
knew.
What
was the immediate local reaction by the Muslims then? Do they immediately go to the streets and rejoice? Like you did hear that in other communities.
Yeah, I mean, I think there would have been a positive reaction to it. Yeah, that was, you know,
from their point of view, positive.
Somebody's getting their own back against the Americans or something like that.
Yeah. Didn't you feel any fear as a result of that?
There was a bit of a build-up of fear, actually, because once perhaps the initial euphoria was passed, then I think there was a sense that the Americans are going to retaliate for this. They're not going to take this sitting down. And there was pressure on a number of foreigners in the country to leave Pakistan because Christians, foreigners tend to be bunched together as being Americans and Christians.
I'll tell you that perhaps you should leave. Then. Did you get nothing official from...
I mean, my suspicion is probably that they did say something like that. And I think around about that time they organised a flight. They did. They had a couple of British Airways planes, which they kind of sold seats for in order that those who wanted to leave, you know, of course, you don't have to have to go. But a number of folks did go. And one of the big deals for us is that our children's school closed down at that particular point because a number of the staff chose to go or were recalled by their missions. And so there wasn't enough kind of staff to run the school. And so in the end, there was a bit of a domino effect. Yeah. And, you know, people left often.
Was that the school that was attacked?
This was a bit later, yes, that's right. Yeah, we're talking the aftermath of 9/11 and how the foreigners kind of left. And then they returned, you know, a little while later because nothing big deal seemed to have happened. And at the point of returning, this was in 2002, so the school was restarted around about February in the winter, wasn't it? You know, there began to be attacks on foreign targets, basically, at around about the time the school was restarted. And the school continued with enhanced protection. But in the end, it was attacked. Yeah, was it? And there were some fatalities, but you know, thankfully, not amongst the kids.
Actually, died,
yeah, there were six people who got killed in the attack, and a number of people got wounded.
And your kids were there, weren't they?
They were there, yes.
And they had to have nightmares for some time after that. Did it really affect them personally, or were they shielded from the action?
I think one of our children felt it more than the others, and. Yeah. For a while, he used to organise his own kind of security arrangements when he went to bed at night. And for a while, also, he had a habit when he went into a new building or a new place, he would sort out his exit route straight away.
Yeah. Does he still do that now he's at LSE? Studying politics.
Was there a reality that after 9/11, the fact that you were Western and not necessarily because you were white, but because you were obviously not from the area, was there a danger that many sort of Muslims wouldn't actually speak to you, not for the Christian point of view, but purely for the fact that you were West? It was almost as if being West didn't help the cause that you were a Christian, it almost hindered it, or was that not really an issue?
I think we felt conscious that at times being present in the area where we lived in Feslabad, which was a very Christian area, that there was the possibility that it kind of might have endangered the people that we mixed with, the other Christians from the Pakistani Christian community. And I suppose we experienced, didn't we, in one particular shop, that we weren't really welcome where we had been welcome before.
And in that sort of climate, was that specifically after 9/11, or was that the mood in general anyway? Because a lot of people, there's the term, think that things are post 9/11, and that when 9/11 happened, everything changed. Yeah, yeah. But was there a climate? Was that the climate anyway, despite what happened? Or is it specifically because that, after that, that's when you started to feel things in the climate a little bit?
What do you reckon? I'd say it increased it, definitely, to the degree that you would notice it and be aware of it.
Yeah, I mean, most people would always have been okay, basically. You know, relatively friendly. Occasionally you bump into somebody who had a thing against, you know, the West or against Israel, against the American, you know, overseas policy and stuff like that. But I think on the whole, you know, most people, you know, were actually, you know, pretty friendly.
So why did you finally come back to this country then?
Well, it was to do with this fact that in the end our family was split up, basically, and I was doing work to do with the language school and with the restarting of the children's school. And I was over in the Murray area, in the northeast of the Punjab, and Mary and the children were in Thailand. But I found it in the end to be really difficult to get the kind of exit permissions to go from Pakistan through to Thailand, so we weren't seeing each other a great deal. And then also, the much of the work I was doing was going to be handed over because we got a new director for the school. So it was kind of the end of the work was in sight. We needed to get together as a family better, and so we came back and here we are.
Would you go back there?
Yeah.
What, as a missionary?
Yeah. Mm. Yes, I would do that or in some other capacity. Yeah, sure.
So if you get the call, off you'll go.
I mean, sometimes the media misplays this a little bit, because I know a lot of people get very spooked about the idea, but actually it's vastly different living there than it is sort of observing, you know, according to what you pick up in the media here.
Yeah. So it's not as bad.
No, it's not. I mean, just life just tricks on, basically, and it's true there are occasional, you know, difficulties and stuff. You know, this huge bomb blast in Islamabad, and this is absolutely tragic. But it's not exactly a daily occurrence. And I remember working in the civil service in Westminster in the times of when the Irish, the IRA, were doing. I remember I was quite close to one of the windows, and there was a big blast and stuff like that. And yet people here, you know, they still travel on the tubes and stuff like that, you know, and it was the situation then. You've got to kind of continue, and that's exactly the mentality, really.
Okay, I mean, I think that was really interesting to actually hear from people that
who did it.
And what it's like, actually, to be there. It's interesting what Jeremy was saying, isn't it?
Yep.
And the last thing we've got today for you is a little discussion, you boys all together, talking about your films and your film themes. Now, let's see if anyone listening can see the connection between a very famous self-assembly furniture company, Superman.
Ikey.
Red-headed actress. What? Someone related to
you. Okay, that's intrigued you, so keep listening and answers on the postcard.
What about films?
Don't talk to me about film.
If you look at film studies, a lot of the in thing in film studies, it's like see biblical things represented. Oh, yeah. Films like, the way that father and son said
looking
that is very
theme,
looking
themes.
For Christian themes. And that's one of the big film studies type things. You look for the Christian themes.
Yeah.
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 And it's very simple to do. Yeah. I've heard people write whole preaches about 10 seconds of a Superman film. Yeah. Actually, there was one guy at a church that I went to, did his whole talk on who is better, Jesus or Superman. And he used Superman and the film of Superman to explain Jesus. Yeah. And he sort of, it's that thing of seeing the theme and then just sort of...
Yeah. I don't know.
Saying that that's perhaps we're too postmodern now and knowing to actually for that to make any impact on people now. Mm. Perhaps it's going back to be overt and just showing Jesus films again, like Passion of the Christ.
Mm. Well, Narnia, the new film, obviously a big blockbuster, very well done movie. Yeah. But they've cleverly, what they've done is they've created like some kind of kids Sunday school type thing, so that using the film, they've got a whole sort of 6-month Sunday school syllabus made from the film. And I think that's clever in its own unique way, because instead of letting the churches work their own stuff, they're saying, look, this is the film, it can be used as an evangelical tool, and this is how.
Well, it depends. I always think about that, because, you know, it's obviously written by a Christian, but in what stage does it have that much of a Christian influence while it's being made and produced and written, and like the screenplay while that's being made? All the imagery used
in their mind when they first had the storyboard about how it could be used for evangelism as well.
Would that work? Hollywood execs?
Really? Are you thinking that the producers of the film?
Yeah, because the executive producer is C.S. Lewis's stepson.
Oh right,
Douglas Gresham. Right. Douglas Gresham, and who's an evangelistic Christian?
Oh, right. He is there, is he?
Yeah,
because he wasn't.
We've seen him interviewed. He's a Christian, right. Yeah. So he was there overseeing the whole film.
I was thinking about this: how churches. With Harry Potter, for example, they go mad. And, oh, no, Harry Potter, witchcraft. And then they'll champion C.S. Lewis, who wrote The Lion, The Witch, and The Wardrobe.
And there's a lot of really dodgy stuff in it, imagery in
there's a lot of
Narnia films.
Pictures and imagery and stuff like that.
It's a bit weird. But then at least you know he was coming from a Christian mindset.
Yeah, I suppose the witch was the bad guy.
That was the Lion, Witch, and then the MFI Wardrobe, it all fell apart.
Slander.
Keep
that out.
Wardrobe.
Is it a poorly constructed plot?
Too much. No, there's film themes. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, thanks for highlighting the title of our conversation. Can we have some content?
I've run out.
What's your favourite film?
I like The Bicycle Thief. Italian Vittorio De Sica.
Oh, one of these weird.
My aunt was in a Vittorio De Sica film.
Really?
Yes. Aunt Jessie.
Oh, is that the fat one?
I'm not the Michael Street Door one.
Yeah, her. They did a trilogy and she was in it with, what's her name? Oh, American actress. That American actress. same era as Jane Fonda. What's her name?
Catherine Hepburn.
Her sister.
Jackie Collins.
No.
Joan Collins.
No, male actor.
Male actor. Peter Fonda.
No.
What?
It's his sister.
A Fonda.
No.
I wasn't a Fonda.
Is this 20 questions?
Yeah.
Am I a vegetable?
Animal, vegetable, or mineral?
Are we supposed to ask?
Is she still alive?
She is.
What's her name? We give up.
Is
it important to the plot?
It is very important.
What colour hair did she have?
Red hair.
Shirley MacLaine.
Shirley MacLaine.
Oh.
That's it.
The new age. The new age.
She, Aunt Jessie. My aunt Jessie. She was in a trilogy, that Vittorio De Sica film.
What, Italian?
With
in Italian?
It was in English.
Oh, right.
But he did it. It was in the 60s.
Yeah, it wasn't.
Shorten this interlude, will you, please?
No. Stretch it out.
Anyway, sorry about that. I interjected.
No. That's fine.
Totally lost the
I was actually done what I was going to say anyway.
The Bicycle Thief is by Vittorio De Sica.
Yes.
My favourite film, The Third Man. Always been my favourite film.
Awesome Worlds.
Which I actually checked up. It's set on the Austrian border.
Oh, that's right, the Austrian border.
Before we were
during the war. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, a good film. I've seen that.
Great film.
Great film noir.
Yes, classic. Indeed.
Yeah. What's your favourite film?
I get really bored of films.
You like Borat.
I just get bored of films most of the time. It's just like, just now it's going to end. It's either going to end really horrifically and strangely, like some avant-garde film, you'll find out the child was actually a demon, it's been on drugs, and everyone kills each other.
Yeah, I saw that one. Yeah,
wasn't it? Some foreign film.
His Aunt Jessie was in that one.
Yeah.
She was a drug dealer.
or it just ends really happily and everyone's in love and that just depresses me.
But is there one film that you remember that you, at the end, you're thinking, oh, that was a good film?
Borat, that's about it, really. Says a lot about my life.
You like Batman?
Batman. Oh, Batman.
Oh, you like Batman.
I loved Heath Ledger.
Dark Knight.
That was good.
Heath Ledger, what a performance.
What a
great performance. You know what? I think
it glorified knife culture, apparently.
Oh, no.
No, because you were sitting there watching someone using knives that was obviously mentally disturbed beyond repair, and you thought, no, I would not want
to. He's a role model for mentally disturbed. So they'll look up to him and think, oh, he's validated what I do.
I did watch it and think, I wonder if there's going to be any criminals in the future that are going to use this very disturbing persona.
Yeah, possibly.
Just not as a laugh, but as a sort of a weird, disturbing...
I can imagine, actually, them using that pencil trick. You want to see a pencil disappear? Bang!
Not good.
Not
possible,
that was all. That was such a good scene. Anyway,
it was very disturbing.
That was really,
but like very human at the same time.
It was a good performance from Heath.
But I think the reason why he's really scary is because we haven't heard Heath Ledger do any interviews much about the character.
Exactly. No.
My point being,
it'd be more disturbing if he did. In a way.
My point being, right?
Wait, give him a nudge, he's not moving.
In a strange way, the character sort of actually killed someone because he played the character, went a bit mad, died. And it's that weird thing, if you're watching knowing this character is partly the reason why that person is dead. So it's kind of extra scary because you never saw the actor behind the character. So in a weird way, he's sort of real. And someone died because of him. It all adds to his reality.
Any other films?
Johnny?
Any cartoons?
Beauty and the Beast.
I would say Snow White.
Oh, no.
We've been over there. Right, Johnny,
analyse
that. Film. Well, I don't know. We have two, really. Zoolander would be one of my favourites. Yeah, it's such a funny film. It's a classic
Tony
film.
Tony fashion, look at him.
Is that the...
Yeah, look at him, radio. That's why I wore it.
I'm with you.
He's wearing a cat suit.
And also, simply because of the reason, it's the only film, like a serious sort of film that I've watched, where I've been very engaged at the end. I've been quite...
Not emotional,
just... I know, it's quite intrigued by it. Donnie Darko, I know, it's quite a modern cult film, but I liked it.
I've got that, I haven't seen it yet.
It's just quite...
Very weird.
But it's Zoolander, weird, but I like
it's one of those...
I'm with you on that one, totally.
Yeah.
Do you know who I wrote Donnie Darko?
Yeah.
Who?
Aunt Jessie.
I know, I thought...
Did you get everywhere?
The thing about Donnie Darko is one of those films that, like, 15, 16-year-olds watch, and they feel really intelligent, so no offence. You watch it, and it's like the first deep film that you get into. It's like, oh man, look, it's not real, but it is real. Oh wow, man, that's so clever. And, like, it's a rabbit. It's like drug references, man.
It was like
how old are you?
It was good. 16. It was like drug references.
15,
and it was so
I'm
deep.
I'm slightly over 15, and I really want to watch it.
It's true.
So that put me off.
No, it's a good film. It's a good film. But I do remember watching it, thinking I'm indulging in my own intelligence watching this. Going, oh look, dear. I can see the plot.
Oh, he's so deep beyond deep.
Yeah, no, that's what it makes you think.
Yeah, he's gone.
Got depths of depth.
Yes, he's. Was it? He's full of. He's deep and meaningless.
Okay, you've been listening to the Saffron Planet show, and thank you for listening. We're on saffronplanet.net if you want to see more or hear more. This week we'd like to thank Jeremy and Mary for their contribution. Apart from that, it's just a normal team, the Maltz, the Worth and the Jeffrey family.
And David.
And David. And anyone else who may have turned up. that's it for this week. Thank you for listening and we'll see you again soon.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.